Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The 1960s brought us one of the most volatile decades in American history. They divided the culture, they changed the culture, and at the dawn and heart of the change, says my guest today, was a band of free-thinking psychic explorers fascinated by hallucinogenics. Timothy Leary was the most famous or infamous, but he was not alone. The lines go out to Aldous Huxley, Jerry Garcia, Ken Kesey, Ted Kaczynski, John Lennon, and the club, says my guest, that changed a nation. This hour on Point, Timothy Leary, his psychedelic club, and the birth of a new cultural age in America. You can join the conversation. Do you buy the link between Timothy Leary and a remaking of American understanding of mind, body, and spirit? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Don Latin. He covered religion for the San Francisco Chronicle for two decades. His new book is The Harvard Psychedelic Club, How Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil Killed the 50s and Ushered in a New Age for America. Don Latin, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
What a story. I kind of thought I knew it, and then I read your telling, and I realized there were thousands of facets that I really had almost no idea of. So much to ask you about here, and you've got big claims in here that these guys and their experimentation and its echo through culture changed the way we think about the very nature of reality. We'll come to those. Take us back to the moment. This is a half century ago now, 1960.
Yeah.
Almost this fall was Timothy Leary's first experiments with hallucinogenics. Before we even get to that, kind of take us back to that cultural moment and this sense of what readiness for something different that was swirling around this country, as you describe it, Don.
Yeah, well, the four guys who I write about in this book, they all came together in Cambridge, Massachusetts, at Harvard and MIT in the fall of 1960. So the 50s were behind us. There was a new decade dawning. And it was an incredible time in American history, especially around Harvard and Cambridge. I mean, John F. Kennedy had just been elected president of the United States. And there was a whole new feeling of hope and optimism in the air. I mean, I was just a kid at the time, but I remember it. People were using words like hope and change, and there was a guy in the White House like no one ever before, and it sort of sounded a little familiar. It was sort of like the feeling some of us had with Barack Obama when he was first in office. But there was definitely a feeling that something new was about to happen in this country, and Timothy Leary and the three gentlemen who crossed paths at Harvard definitely helped fuel that throughout the 60s, 70s, and beyond.
Something familiar, and yet a different stage of ferment here. These guys, Timothy Leary, Andrew Weil, that many people will know from his work with alternative medicine and in organic food and all the rest. Ram Dass, who brought so much spirituality from the East, Richard mm-hmm. Alpert at that time before he took that name. And your kind of hero here, Houston, who wrote The Religion of Man.
Yeah, Houston Smith was a philosophy professor at MIT. And, as you mentioned, Leary first took psychedelic drugs on his summer vacation in Mexico in the summer of 1960. He was there with some friends and lounging around the pool at a rented villa with some anthropologists, one of whom scored some psilocybin mushrooms. And he didn't really know what to expect. He had an incredible journey on these drugs. He later described it as the most profound religious experience of his life. And he came back to Harvard and started working with one of his colleagues in the psychology department, or the Department of Social Relations, actually, at Harvard, a guy by the name of Richard Alpert, an mm-hmm. assistant professor who would later become Ram Dass after going to India and returning reincarnated mm-hmm. as Ram Dass. But Leary came back to to Harvard on fire. He was convinced that psychedelic drugs were going to at least revolutionize psychology, give us a whole new window into how the mind works. But also, he saw this as a spiritual revolution, that they were going to change the way Americans conceive of the very nature of reality. And so Leary and Alpert were having all these spiritual, mystical, religious experiences, but they didn't really expect that. They were not religious people. They were not spiritual people. They were secular. They were scientists. Mm-hmm. So that's why they brought Houston Smith in, who had been already writing about religion and mysticism for a decade. He was a serious student of yoga.
This is the son of Christian missionaries in China, Su Chao.
Yeah, yeah. Houston was born in China. He lived in China. He grew up in China and didn't come to the United States until he came to go to a little Bible college in the Midwest, fully intending to go back to China as a Methodist missionary, mm-hmm. like his father and grandfather before him. But he got here, and even though it was a little town in the middle of the Midwest, it was like bright lights, big city for Houston. Mm-hmm. He'd never seen anything like it. He'd never seen his America before. So he decided to stay and was going to become a preacher here. And very soon he decided that teaching, not preaching, was his calling. So he became one of the leading scholars of the world's religions. His textbook, originally called The Religions of Man, mm-hmm. Now called The World's Religions, was published in 1950, just a couple years before all the craziness began.
And before you know it, he's on public television in this country, very straight-looking guy, talking about the Bhagavad Gita, and up on the desk demonstrating right. the lotus yes. position to millions of
yeah.
Americans who never considered
yeah.
such a thing.
Yeah, you have to remember, most Americans had never heard of yoga at that time. Or very, yeah, you know, some had, but it was a new thing for people. And Houston was on. Yeah, it was before PBS. Actually, it was the old NET, National mm-hmm. Educational Television, mm-hmm. and he was talking about, you know, his book, but giving a course on the world's religions. So they brought Leary brought Houston in as kind of a theological consultant to try to help them figure out, are these authentic or real spiritual experiences that we're having. And Houston, from his point of view, he'd been meditating, but he'd never had what he would call a real full-blown mystical experience. He'd interviewed people who'd had them. He'd been writing about, you know, mystics and saints and sadhus
and he wanted it.
But he wanted it. He wanted to experience what he was writing about. And, of course, he had read a book which was very central to this whole story, mm-hmm. The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley, mm-hmm. which had been written about 6 or 7 years earlier, which described Huxley's first mescaline trip, mm-hmm. Which he took in his home in the Hollywood Hills in the spring of 1953. And that book was really the book of Genesis for the psychedelic drug movement, which happened later in the 60s and 10 years later. Mm. So Houston was actually good friends with Aldous Huxley, and he had read his book, and he was eager to explore these fantastic realms and these visions and
there's so many characters to meet here, and we're going to meet more and more of them. But take us back to Leary. I mean, talk about flamboyant, but I'm looking at pictures here from your book back in late 50s or 60. He looks like somebody out of Mad Men. Looks very straight. I didn't know he'd been in Berkeley, had already had, by the time he came out here, had a wife who had committed suicide in Berkeley. And who was this guy? We came to know him as kind of a media caricature. Maybe he became something of that himself, but introduce us to Timothy Leary.
Right. Well, Timothy Leary was, people forget, because he became so infamous later on in the 60s. But in the 1950s, he was a rising star in mainstream clinical psychology. He came to Berkeley originally to get his PhD, and he wound up helping start the psychology department at Kaiser Hospital, which is now Kaiser Permanente, mm-hmm. one of the largest healthcare providers in the country. But he was losing faith in mainstream clinical psychology. He did one study at Kaiser to look at the effectiveness of psychotherapy and basically found out that people who are on a waiting list were having about the same outcomes as people who are actually getting the psychotherapy. Mm. And so he started looking for other ways. And he had some personal crises in his life, too. His wife, as you mentioned, committed suicide in their home in the Berkeley Hills.
They were in their 30s, I guess.
1955. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And leaving him with two children, mm-hmm. which he tried to raise on his own throughout all this craziness and later on in the 60s. Mm-hmm. But you know, he wrote a book on in the late 50s. He wrote a book on personality assessment, which was named one of the most important books of the year by the American Psychological Association. So he was considered a rising star in clinical psychology.
His impact before it's all over, stretching all over the place, including into culture. The Beatles wrote a campaign song for him when he later ran against Ronald Reagan in California. They wrote
right.
"Tomorrow Never Knows," inspired by
two Beatles songs. John Lennon, now we're jumping ahead, of course, to 1963-64, when Leary and Richard Alpert and a gentleman named Ralph Metzner, who was very important in this story too, wrote a book called The Psychedelic Experience. It came out in 1964, and it was really it was a guidebook, basically, for how to have an LSD trip. You also have to remember that LSD was legal at the time. LSD wasn't illegal in most of this country till 1966. So anyway, John Lennon was one of the people who read this book, The Psychedelic Experience, which is it's in itself based on another text, a mystical text, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And anyway, John Lennon wrote this song, "Tomorrow Never Knows." It's the last song on Revolver, the first kind of psychedelic spacey Beatles record before Rubber Soul and Sgt. Pepper's. And it's basically the lyrics of that song are right out of Leary's book and also out of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And he wrote the book while on LSD.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the story of Timothy Leary, his psychedelic club of the early 60s, and the mark it left on American understanding of mind, body, and spirit. Don Latton is with us. He joins us today from Berkeley, California, written a very entertaining and illuminating new history of that time and its aftermath called the Harvard Psychedelic Club. The web of connections that go out from this into the 60s culture is kind of astonishing, and we'll look at that, Don. But take us to those first experiments with actually LSD and so on. I guess this is in Cambridge or neighboring Newton, Massachusetts, actually 1960, big house there, and off they went. What did they think they were doing?
Well, they actually didn't know exactly what they were doing. They didn't know what they really didn't understand these substances at first.
Mm-hmm.
Leary had a big house in Newton, Massachusetts, near Harvard, and that he did a lot of these experiments in his home with graduate students and others who would basically just take the drug. Initially, it wasn't LSD. It was psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in so-called magic mushrooms produced by a laboratory, so you can control the dose. And they were just getting basically, field reports from people taking these trips and looking for patterns and just trying to understand what was going on. But very soon, Leary started two projects. One was the Concord Prison Project, where they gave psilocybin. They actually took psilocybin with prisoners at Concord Prison in Massachusetts. And the test was to see if they could reduce recidivism rates.
Which was very high. You say the wardens were open to almost anything that would help them bring that down. And this drug didn't have a big reputation, good or ill, at that time. It was kind of a new thing.
No, people really hadn't heard of these drugs at all. I mean, some people had read about magic mushrooms, peyote. I mean, Native American religion and spirituality, but they were
in the general culture at that time, it was hardly standard conversation.
No, actually, a lot of Americans first heard about these LSD at least when Cary Grant gave an interview to a Hollywood gossip columnist, a syndicated gossip columnist, and he said that he'd been taking LSD with a psychotherapist and had a breakthrough that had taken him 10 years of traditional psychotherapy. And he was giving this ringing endorsement of LSD. Cary Grant, yeah. And a lot of people were, not a lot, but I mean, certain numbers of people were taking these drugs with their psychotherapists in the 1950s, before Leary even discovered this.
So a Life magazine columnist, you remind us, wrote about, kind of glowingly about, I forget if it was mescaline or which, but one of these hallucinogenics.
Yeah, it was the magic mushrooms, psilocybin mm-hmm. mushrooms. This guy, R. Gordon Wasson, who was kind of an amateur explorer of psychedelic plants, and he wrote just a glowing article in Life magazine
of all places
in the 1950s. Yeah, I mean, there were a lot. It's funny, you know. Later on, LSD got such a bad reputation as being dangerous and leading to all kinds of other problems and with you know, drugs and psychological problems, even suicide. Mm-hmm. But early on, it was seen as a promising new tool for mainstream psychotherapists to use. And they were using it. And there's all kinds of research going on before Leary to see if, for instance, if LSD could be used to treat alcoholism. And they didn't quite understand how it was working, but they soon discovered that actually it was – what was happening is the alcoholics, some would have a spiritual awakening on these drugs and reexamine their lives and their relationship with alcohol and have the kind of spiritual awakening that actually they talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous.
The founder of AA even got involved at that level.
Yeah, he's one of the characters in my book too, and I didn't realize this, but Bill Wilson, until I started doing the research on this book, Bill Wilson took a lot of LSD in the 1950s with Aldous Huxley and a gentleman named Gerald Hurd, who's also an important part of the story. And like I said, they weren't doing this just to get high. I mean, Wilson was already had sobered up. AA had been going for 20 years mm-hmm. by the 1950s. But he really saw this as a way for alcoholics to have the spiritual awakening that, according to AA and the 12-step movement, is essential to overcome addiction and kind of start a new way of life, a new way of relating to people.
And, of course, there was the CIA interest, which was not about spiritual growth. They saw a potential weapon or something here.
Yeah, they had all kinds of – a lot of the research, early research, was funded by the Army or the CIA. I mean, they were thinking that LSD could be used as a truth serum for interrogating prisoners, as a chemical weapon. I say in the book it could be sprayed on enemy
armies.
Troops as a weapon, mm-hmm. as a weapon of mass destruction.
Yes. Even Ted Kaczynski comes into the story, the Unabomber around the CIA connection.
Yeah. He was at Harvard. He was an undergraduate at Harvard. And this is, again, before Leary and mm-hmm. Alpert were doing their research. And he was a subject in some psychological stress tests that the Harvard-affiliated group was doing for the Army, a researcher by the name of Harry Murray, not Leary. And some of these individuals were given psychedelic drugs. Others were just subjected to a lot of psychological stress to see how they'd respond. And Kaczynski was one of these guys. And there's actually a whole other book has been written about this called Harvard and the Unabomber. I just mentioned mm-hmm. it in my book. Mm-hmm. But, you know, remember, Kaczynski had this whole thing about research and science. And some people, the author of this previous book on Kaczynski, thinks it was partly because of his experiences at Harvard and some of the emotional and psychological problems he had were at least exasperated by psychedelic drugs or the stress tests that he went through.
So we come back to Leary. There's Concord Prisoners. That went on for a while. There was also, you describe, just down the road from where I am here at Marsh Chapel at Boston University, the Good Friday experiment. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Good Friday experiment was one of the most interesting things that Leary and his graduate students did. A graduate student by the name of Walter Pankey was actually the main researcher. Leary was kind of the academic advisor. But the idea was to take 20 seminary students from a nearby seminary and during a Good Friday service, an actual, you know, worship service mm-hmm. in Marsh Chapel, they were down in the basement getting the audio feed from upstairs.
The sermon.
The main
yeah.
chapel,
mm-hmm.
the sermon and the hymns and, you know, the whole service, a Good Friday service. And half of the 10 seminarians were given a placebo, which actually was a drug that had sort of made their skin kind of a prickly heat. It was mm-hmm. nicotinic acid, which the idea was to fool them, thinking they got
a little
the psychedelic
something,
drug.
Yeah,
basically a placebo, mm-hmm. and the other 10 were given psilocybin, and the idea was to see what sort of religious experience these seminarians would have. And of course, the 10 who took the drug were, you know, they were, you know, proclaiming the gospel, and, you know, one guy was convinced he was the Messiah and tried to run out the door into mm-hmm. the streets of Boston and
did run out.
And then they were given these tests later on to determine if they had an authentic spiritual experience. Sounds kind of funny to give a test, but they asked questions like, did you have experience awe and wonder or a sense of transcendence or unity or compassion? And the study found that the 10 did did have, the 10 who got the drug did have those experiences. And basically the conclusion was these were, quote, authentic, close quote, spiritual experiences. Of course, the important thing I think that people realized later was, well, so what? Maybe you had an experience, but what did you do with that experience in the rest of your life? And that's kind of the important thing and kind of one of the lessons I kind of that we learned through this, through my book.
There's so much here. It's a very rich book, The Harvard Psychedelic Club, How Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil Killed the 50s and Ushered in a New Age for America. We haven't even come to Andrew Weil yet and the decline of the club and the explosion of the culture, but we have a lot of listeners who want in here. Don Latin joins us from Berkeley, California. Nan in Franklin, Tennessee. Nan, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I just wanted to relate. There seemed to be a lot of humor with Leary. And I have another one that's kind of comical, too.
Great.
I was directing a couple of plays, Albee plays, at Emory University.
In Atlanta, yeah.
In Atlanta. And I earlier that afternoon, he had appeared on the scene. And, of course, it was a huge mob.
What year, roughly, Nan, are we talking about here?
Pardon me?
What year might this be, roughly?
It's mid-60s.
Okay.
And I can't remember if it was before or after this was... it might have been even interesting if it was after, but if it was before, it was kind of sort of thumbs down on it. But anyway, I went in there. I think they were there about 1 o'clock, and at 3:30 or 4, I went in to set up for the theater, and the place was strewn, and I mean strewn, with sugar cubes. The whole floor was covered in sugar cubes.
Were these doctored sugar cubes? Was this an acid test?
I think they were just fakes.
I see.
But,
just
there was. I mean, the whole floor was covered with them. It was a huge room we're talking about.
Yes.
And I couldn't find a broom. I couldn't find anybody that would help me. And I know somehow we got it swept to the side, and did the show, which was a couple of Albies anyway, which are a little bit on the skewed side anyway. So this was kind of a double comic. But
and did Leary give a speech, a presentation there, Nan?
Huh?
Did Leary give a speech or a presentation?
Yes. And they just, I mean, the kids just piled in there, and they were overflowing, and I said the windows were open, they were standing in there, and they were standing outside, and it was just a riot. And then what was left were all these strewn sugar cubes.
Don Latin, he was a Pied Piper. Some would say a huckster. Others would say, you know, a one-of-a-kind seeker. How do you end up looking at Leary?
Well, you mentioned his sense of humor, and he had a great sense of humor. I mean, I call him a trickster in my book. And a trickster is someone who uses tricks to kind of enlighten us and shake us out of our normal way of thought and thinking. And, you know, yeah, who was Leary? Was he a prophet? Was he a shameless self-promoter? I mean, he probably answered the question best when someone later in his life asked him, well, which are you? Who are you, Timothy mm-hmm. Leary? And his reply was, you get the Timothy Leary you deserve. Which is a classic kind of a trickster answer. We're throwing it back on you. You mentioned Richard Nixon called him the most dangerous man in America.
Mm-hmm.
When Leary first heard that, he replied without skipping a beat, "Oh yeah, well I have America surrounded." You know, so I mean, a guy who can come up with lines like that, you know,
Nixon, no small threat himself. Now here he is. He's got coming into this house. This is way back again. This intense burst of interest in this in 1960, and up show Allen Ginsberg and Alan Watts and William Burroughs. I mean, there's just a flurry here. There's one who doesn't exactly get into the magic circle, and that is Andrew Weil, a kind of a chubby young undergraduate who ends up bringing down their reign of LSD at Harvard. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, a lot of people think they know what happened to Leary and Alpert at Harvard, but the full story has never really been told till my book. And it does involve Andrew Weil, who goes on to become Dr. Andrew Weil, a leading proponent of holistic health and alternative medicine. But at the time, he was an undergraduate at Harvard, and he wanted to be a research subject in the Psilocybin Project. He had also read The Doors of Perception. But Leary and Alpert had agreed not to use undergraduate students as research subjects, only graduate students. So they were turned down. And Weil actually approached them with a friend of his, a guy by the name of Ronnie Winston, who was the son of Harry Winston, of the Harry Winston Jewelry Diamond Company, a prominent East Coast family. And so what happened is later on, Richard Alpert, the man who would be Ram Dass, mm-hmm. met Ronnie Winston at a party and became friends with him and led him in some psilocybin sessions, even though he was an undergraduate. And Weil heard that some other undergraduates were also being brought into the fold. Very quickly, this research project was morphing into something else. Some would call it a religious cult or a drug cult around Leary and Alpert. Mm-hmm. Others would call it the beginning of the 60s counterculture. But Andrew Weil was jealous that he wasn't led into the psychedelic family. And so what he did was he decided to bring this whole thing down. And he went he started an investigation for the Harvard Crimson, the student newspaper at Harvard. And he was trying to get undergraduates to admit that they were given these drugs. Well, none would, including his old friend Ronnie Winston. So Andrew Weil went to Ronnie Winston's father and said, your son is taking these drugs against university regulations with his professor at Harvard. And if he doesn't admit it to the administration, we're going to put his name in the paper. Well, the last thing this family wanted was to be named in a big drug scandal at Harvard.
Right,
so they put pressure, his father, Harry Winston, put pressure on Ronnie to go to the president of Harvard's office and fess up, because they were looking for a reason to fire Alpert and Leary. They saw they had two loose cannons on their hands. Mm-hmm. So Ronnie Winston goes into the president of Harvard's office and was asked, son, did Professor Alpert give you psilocybin? And Ronnie paused and said, yes, sir, he did. And it was the most educational experience I've had at Harvard.
And Mr. President.
They said, well, we don't care about that. Thank you very much.
Right.
I mean, now they had the goods on Professor Alpert. And that is the charge they used to fire Alpert and also to get rid of Leary. And so the deal was that the Harvard administration would give the Crimson, you know, one day's notice before they fired him. So the Crimson had the story. Page one on the Crimson, along with a vicious editorial attacking Leary and Alpert as quacks and as a virus infecting the campus community. I mean, really hardcore stuff. Mm-hmm. And the next day, it was front page of the New York Times. And Leary and Alpert were history and thrust into the national spotlight as the, you know, the two Pied Pipers of LSD and the psychedelic counterculture.
And they never—
But it was Andrew Weil who brought them down.
And they never forgave Andrew Weil.
They're still working on it.
I mean, you went to see Ram Dass in Hawaii. He still struggled with that, even after all journeys.
Yeah, I interviewed everyone involved in the story, so there's no question about what happened. I interviewed Ronnie Winston. I interviewed Andrew Weil. Mm-hmm. I interviewed Ram Dass. And, you know, publicly, Andrew Weil and Ram Dass have made up. Weil even gave a fundraiser to help Ram Dass pay for some medical bills. But when you talk to Ram Dass about this, you can see that he still has some problems with the way Andrew Weil went about this. I mean, he was working as a spy for the Harvard administration and a journalist at the same time, which is, you know, quite a questionable thing to do in terms of journalistic ethics. And basically ruined Ram Dass's or Professor Alpert's career. But, I mean, I think everyone realizes that they were probably going to get kicked out of Harvard anyway, because this thing was just mushrooming, pardon the expression, on campus there in the early mid-60s.
And the next thing you know, it is out in the world. It is out in the country, really the whole country. And something which had been a very kind of intense experience in one little corner was just exploding right across the culture of this nation, Don.
Right, and that's what Leary did. I mean, there's a lot of research and a lot of people had taken, I mean, certain people have taken psychedelic drugs before Leary, but he thought this was for everyone. He took these drugs out of the lab and into the street. And that is what prompted this backlash against him and against the whole counterculture later on.
A backlash, but also, writes Don Latin, a fundamental change, even in the mainstream, of how Americans look at mind, body, and spirit. We'll come back and look at that. Here's the Moody Blues with Legend of the Mind from 1968 about Timothy Leary and LSD. Don Latin's new book is The Harvard Psychedelic Club. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Along the coast you'll hear them boast about a light they say that shines so clear. So raise your glass, we'll drink a toast to the little man who sells you thrills along the pier. He'll take you up, he'll bring you down, he'll plant your feet back firmly on the ground. He flies so high, he swoops so low, he knows exactly which way he's gonna go.
Timothy Leary.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Behind us, the Beatles come together. John Lennon originally wrote the song, I didn't know this, for Timothy Leary's 1969 campaign for governor of California against Ronald Reagan. His bid fell apart when he was arrested and sent to jail for possession of marijuana. The Beatles recorded the song anyway, and it's just one piece of the story Don Latin tells in his new book, The Harvard Psychedelic Club, how Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil killed the 50s and ushered in a new age for America. Don Latin joins us from Berkeley, California. Let's go to our listeners, Gary in Sandown, New Hampshire. Gary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Don.
Hi.
Thank you for taking on this important and controversial subject.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great show. My story is I had two parents killed by a drunken driver when I was 8 years old. I'm 57 now, but I took LSD when I was about 15, and I got such a heightened sense of alertness. I kind of said to God, I said, God, you know, where's my parents and why were they taken? And I admit it might have been a hallucination, but in about 1 second, I felt a presence and a voice inside me that said, see, we have no bodies. And that's all they said. And it kind of saved my life because I thought that the world was very unfair, and I didn't want to stick around to get killed by somebody, and I didn't want to kill anybody. And it seemed like it saved my life.
A sense of understanding, a sense of insight that came to you there.
Yeah, well, you know, I wanted to make some logic and sense out of life, and it just didn't seem right that my parents disappeared overnight. And I wanted to know where they were and why they were taken, and I felt that they were in good hands after that. I said that you know, our souls must be indestructible.
Gary, it's powerful testimony, and you're not the only one who came out of that era with some sense like that. Of course, others with terrible stories. Art Linkletter lost his daughter, Diane, who was tripping. But you write, Don, about it in a couple of different ways, about people who said, well, doors of perception may be opened here, but there may be a cost or a limit, too. You reminded us of Houston Smith saying, you know, yeah, you can go off and do this, but you've ultimately got to find it yourself. Richard Alpert, Ram Dass, when he went to India, was told on a mountaintop with a guru, more or less the same thing.
Yeah, that you're the caller. That was a great call and a very profound story. And that happened in some way, shape, or form to millions, literally millions of people in this country. Millions of people took these drugs, and they're actually still taking them, by the way. Young people are still doing this, maybe with a different motivation. I'm not exactly sure. But anyway, millions of people had profound, mystical, soul-shattering experiences. Some had terrifying experiences as well, the so-called bad trips. But these drugs, I think they changed the way so many people look at the relationship, for instance, between mind, body, and spirit. And, you know, Andrew Weil, who's a big part of this story, kind mm-hmm. of as the villain early on, but he goes on in the book to redeem himself. I mean, he says in an interview with me that his experiences on psychedelic drugs were what showed him a new kind of relationship between the mind, body, and spirit. As a medical doctor, he went on to graduate from Harvard Medical School, and he has set up now centers for, he calls it integrative medicine, basically taking the best of Eastern and Western medicine. And he has helped set up medical centers like this across the country at mainstream medical schools. And he was a pioneer in this in the early 70s, in this holistic health and well-being movement, which is so strong now. It's not unusual at all for doctors now to prescribe meditation for cardiac patients as stress reduction. This is one of, I think, the main ways we can see the impact of these drugs on the culture. The other way, you mentioned Houston Smith and Ram Dass. The other way is the whole new way people look at religion and spirituality today. I've been covering religion, writing about religion for 20, 25 years, and every year more and more people will say they're, quote, spiritual but not religious. Mm-hmm. Now, what do people mean by that? I think what they mean is they're interested in the experience of spirituality and of religion, the religious experience more than dogma and doctrine and denominationalism. And, of course, there are lots of reasons for that, not just psychedelic drugs, but I think one of the major reasons are the experiences that people had on these drugs, and then they went on to look for other kinder, gentler ways to experience this sense of wonder and awe and connectedness. And many, following Ram Dass, who went to Richard Alpert went to India, came back as Ram Dass, and became one of the seminal spiritual teachers of my generation. By that I mean the baby boom generation. And so I think those are the two main areas, health and well-being and religion and spirituality, where these four men and the whole psychedelic movement, you can really see that in the background.
You quote Harvey Cox, the theologian, saying, it left permanent marks on our society, including changes in psychology, politics, the food we eat, how we think about mental and physical health. And then of your book, he says, this is not just a book about magic mushrooms or LSD. It's a story of a turning point we are still living with. On the other hand, you know, we've got listeners and emailers on all sides of this thing. Here's an email from Dale, and she writes, I don't buy it. I grew up in the 50s, came of age in the 60s. Leary and his club may indeed have had a hand in shaping the 60s, but the 50s had already begun changing under the influence of many explorations of spirituality. Leary was a bit player, she says, an evangelist whose stage crumbled while he was still on it. What do you say, Don?
Well, you know, there were all kinds of things going on. I mean, deconstructing a decade is a dangerous task. I mean, all kinds of things are going on in this country. There was the post-war economic boom after World War II, civil rights, the war in Vietnam, beginnings of feminism, gay liberation. All kinds of things were going on, obviously. I mean, psychedelic drugs were just a part of this. And she's right. Leary's stage did crumble. I mean, he was thrown in prison by the authorities.
Escaped to North Africa with the help of the Weatherman Underground and Bill Ayers and all that. I didn't know
that. Yeah, he has an incredible story. But, you know, we keep talking about Timothy Leary, and one of the challenges in this book was to not let Leary dominate it because he had such an incredible life.
Mm-hmm.
But I argue in the book that he had the least long-term impact of the four gentlemen that I write about. I think Houston Smith, Ram Dass, and Andrew Weil had much more of a positive long-term impact. I mean, Leary was revered and reviled by people on the left and in the counterculture as well. He was a controversial character.
We've got it coming in both ways here. Here's a Facebook or website comment from Gerald. Says, Dr. Leary seems to have the soul of a huckster, but he always seemed to have conned himself first, making himself something of an innocent. Using other people. And then with kind of for the casualties of acid, Don writes, that's Darwin for you, baby. And on Leary would go. But here's Cynthia calling from Burlington, Vermont. Cynthia, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi there. I met Dr. Leary a couple of times, and I think that he's just this unbelievably charismatic Irishman. I was a Harvard student in the 1970s. I think that my set and I were really regretted that we weren't there in the 60s. But I just wanted to say that, you know, my experiences with LSD certainly were phenomenal for me. And I think, you know, in terms of what your speaker said, they took me beyond ideology in terms of religion and really set me on a path. And I think, you know, that Leary and Alpert have been just incredibly influential in our society. And I think that at some point that psychotherapy and psychedelics really will converge, because I think that the work that Stanislav Grof did with LSD and psychotherapy is just completely fascinating. And the last thing that I want to say is that, you know, I think that, you know, Andrew Weil made a good buck on all of this stuff, you know, starting with the natural
mind. Empire. And,
I think that Tim Leary will be remembered, especially for that whole set and setting stuff that he did as a psychologist in terms of thinking about the therapeutic uses of LSD. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Cynthia. Thank you. Don, what about it today? Is it seen as, you know, in the, I don't know, the trash bin of history, or is this still active? Is it back?
No, I think we're just starting to really understand, and because there was such a backlash against Leary and the whole drug culture of the 60s and 70s, in some ways for good reason. But what's interesting now is it's taken almost 50 years, but there is a whole new wave of research being done on not just LSD, but other psychedelic drugs, other people call them and some people call them entheogens, I mean, sort of God-manifesting drugs or various words people use, for use in psychotherapy. And there's a whole – all across the country, research institutes and universities, we're studying this again. But it's taken that long to get over the backlash that Leary prompted. But people are looking at use of these substances for to treat post-traumatic stress syndrome. Mm-hmm. The FDA just approved a pilot study looking at whether Gulf War and Iraq War veterans can be helped with these drugs, mostly ecstasy, which is MDMA, in dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. There's a renewed look at this in terms of alcoholism, of end-of-life issues, of helping people understand the life and death. There's all kinds of exciting research going on right now with these drugs, and it's happened all just in the last 5 or 10 years. This has really started picking up again.
Amazing. It's 50 years since that 1960 Leary, swan dive into this whole world. Jack in Columbia, South Carolina. Jack, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Don. Yeah, great show today. This is really a lot of fun. I don't think there's any way, Don, I don't think there's any way you can overestimate the impact that the psychedelic experience and these academic pioneers had on Western culture, American culture. Politics, music, film, they were all dramatically affected. Mm-hmm. I'm 52 years old. I came to this through literature. Originally read The Psychedelic Experience, Be Here Now, Carlos Castaneda's books. Even living in South Carolina, I was lucky enough to have met Dr. Leary and I've met Ram Dass. I've actually met Owsley Stanley and Jerry Garcia.
Owsley Stanley, who was the producer of so much LSD in this country back in the day.
Who also was touring around with the Grateful Dead. He was their sound man for a long time and was an active fan. That's how I got to meet him, actually, in the late 1980s several times. And I just want to thank you so much for writing this book. We're still living in this culture, and a lot of the social conservatives today are still moving in the backlash against what the psychedelic experience brought to American culture. I just wanted to thank you so much. And could you maybe put something out there about the differences between the way Leary and the Harvard crowd treated psychedelic substances and the way Ken Kesey and the Mary Pranksters on the West Coast and the Grateful Dead people.
That's a great question, sure. Jack. Let's do that because your book goes right there from the East Coast right into the Berkeley and Kesey and all the rest. Tell us about the difference
there. Well, the first few chapters of the Harvard Psychedelic Club take place in and around Boston. But as people who went through this or studied this era know, the action kind of shifted westward in around 1965, 66. Everyone started coming out to San Francisco. With or without flowers in their hair. And one of the leaders on the West Coast, there were really two separate – there was some interaction between but two separate movements going on. There was the Leary and Alpert crowd, but then there was Ken Kesey. Ken Kesey, interestingly enough, was given LSD by the U.S. government in a Veterans Administration study near Stanford. And Ken Kesey went on to form this kind of guerrilla theater group called the Merry Pranksters.
Made famous by Tom Wolfe, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test.
Yeah, fantastic book. And basically they were having these giant parties and celebrations, so-called acid tests, where, you know, the punch was spiked and much wilder stuff than Leary and Alpert were doing. I mean, they were so notorious, but they were still buttoned down academics and, you know, in the mid-60s, especially Leary, they were being very careful in their early research, at least. Whereas Kesey, it was Dionysian. I mean, this was it was definitely a party, and much less. I think more dangerous too. I mean, people were given these drugs who, you know, I mean, I'm really not endorsing these drugs in the sense that people should in any kind of haphazard way take them. For one thing, they're illegal. And the other thing is they can be psychologically very dangerous. And I write at the end of the book, I have an afterword where I talk about some of the incredible experiences I had and some of the real terrifying, psychologically damaging experiences that I had with LSD. So, you know, I don't want us to get too swept away in the wonder and awe of it. We have to treat these drugs with respect and caution.
Absolutely. Our caller, Jack, and you, for that matter, in the book, write about one of the great outcomes being this cultural standoff, this conflict that Jack spoke to and you've spoken to. How would you define the heart of that? What's the cultural conflict over this perspective that Leary brought that's still there and active as you write today?
Yeah, well, it's really a whole new way of seeing reality, basically. I mean, it's that basic, you know, and it's, I mean, people when they take these drugs can have a sense of kind of oneness and interconnectedness with nature, with each other. I mean, and it really can make you question your values, and especially if your values have to do with consumerism and materialism. And a lot of people turned against that in the 60s. And drugs weren't the only reason, but I think one of the major reasons were the insights and experiences that people had on these drugs.
Is that why Richard Nixon called Timothy Leary the most dangerous man in America?
I think it is.
He would undermine the consumer economy?
That's what the best of the whole hippie counterculture thing was. It was a spiritual movement, and it was against materialism and consumerism. It was challenging those, and that was the reigning religion, still is the reigning philosophy religion in this country is consumerism. And Leary and Alpert and Houston Smith and even Andrew Weil, although he's made a lot of money off of it himself, were questioning all of that.
Came with its own shadows, as you write, and you quote Houston Smith saying, you talk about him saying, what separated him from the pack was his understanding that the real test of a person's spirit is the way they live their lives. It's what happens after the ecstasy.
Right. Exactly. I mean, we can have these experiences, whether they're profound, positive, revelatory, or scary, terrifying, soul-shattering experiences. But what do we do with it? Does it make us a better person? How does it affect the way we live our lives? Are we more compassionate and aware? That's the real test.
It's fascinating, controversial, and important history, and you bring it to life in a very vivid way, Don. The new book is The Harvard Psychedelic Club, How Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil Killed the 50s and ushered in a new age for America. Don Lattin in Berkeley, California, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll go out with a little Jefferson Airplane, White Rabbit. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.